Welcome to Crosslink Radio. This is Shirley Gutkowski, and I am your host again today. This is the show where we talk about health from the eye teeth on down, and it's a critical show because nobody else seems to be talking about what happens in the mouth and how it affects overall health. There's a lot of talk right now about the gut microbiome and the gut this and the gut that. Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. The gut starts right after the lips. That's where everything starts. And I don't know that we in healthcare or they in healthcare talk about it often enough. So that's why I've created this show called Crosslink Radio. And I'm happy that you're with us. And please make any comments that you feel are important in Stitcher or in iTunes. All of that helps to increase the footprint of this show. And because it's so unique, and maybe I'm not the perfect host or I have weird speech patterns or the audio quality isn't awesome, the content, I think, is really important, really super important to share with everybody in healthcare. And we have to have a bigger part of our brain allocated towards oral health when we're talking about healthcare in general. Over the years, I have been a speaker and a writer, and I've been very critical about some of the things that we do in dental hygiene, in the practice of dental hygiene. And this is for hygienists and for patients both. And I want you both to all listen because I think it's really important that we both come at this from the same piece of information. So one of the ways that we have been traditionally checking for periodontal disease is by doing periodontal readings. So we go 3, 2, 3, 4, 4, 2, 2, 1, 2, you know, so patients who have been hearing that are listening to a dental hygienist measuring the height of the bone as it relates to the top of the gum tissue. So if you have bone loss and your gums are swollen, you're going to get a higher number. Okay, so if you can imagine that your bone has receded underneath the gums where you can't see it, and your gums are swollen a little bit because they are infected, and we have what's considered to be a case of periodontal disease, which is undiagnosed by anything other than this measuring stick that we're using to measure the height of the bone against the top of the top of the gums. All right. So if you were able to get the gums to not be swollen anymore, that number would be different. If you have a place where the gums have receded, you may have a reading that is much, much smaller than what is true. So if you imagine that your gums have receded and the hygienist puts the probe in there, or the dentist, and measures a 1, you still have many millimeters of bone loss that are unmeasured. So a lot of times hygienists will go through the exercise of measuring the amount of recession that is present on every part of every tooth as well. So this measurement activity is extremely, it's not extremely painful, but it is uncomfortable. It does increase cortisol and it does increase stress measurements in the patient, but it's also very tedious and time consuming. In a time where dental hygienists are asked to do more and more things in shorter and shorter amount of time, often this exercise gets either shortened or eliminated 100%. So you may not have a current periodontal charting in your chart. And that's neither good nor bad, because the whole exercise doesn't tell us what we think it's telling us. We're using old measurements to measure new disease, because now we know that a periodontal infection contributes to overall health or disease. and it may be either a window to a disease or may be a cause of the disease. For instance, let's take periodontal disease against diabetes. There is a wing of research, there's a line of research that is looking at the cause and effect between the two. So some researchers are wondering aloud and looking for answers to this question as to whether periodontal disease contributes to diabetes. Meaning that you don't have diabetes, you have periodontal disease, and your periodontal disease kind of causes the diabetes. There's a much more robust research area that looks at diabetes causing periodontal disease. So on the one hand, you have a window to health, right? With looking at the gums and noticing that there's a periodontal infection and surmising that that may be a reason you have diabetes, and knowing that you have diabetes and going the other way back and forth. So we have this bidirectional thing happening with respect to the health of the mouth. So my whole thing is that we who are still doing periodontal charting and traditional periodontal therapy are not doing the best for our patients, because we really are looking for late stage diagnostics. We're waiting for the bone to disappear before we even notice that they have a periodontal infection or periodontal disease. So when our patients come to us and we do a periodontal reading and we have numbers that are within normal limits, then we don't take any further action, even though there may be a yet undiagnosed infection or breakdown of the hard and soft tissues. So if you can just imagine this for a second. Now you have a condition. The condition up until probably 1998 or so was only a condition measured by the amount of bone that was lost. And today, now that it's 2014, we are still only looking and waiting for the bone to be lost, even though we have tests that we can do looking at the DNA of the bacteria that are present, not just waiting for colonies to form. We're measuring the number of bacteria that's present that are causing this deterioration of the hard and soft tissue, but nobody's doing it. This is a bad problem in a bunch of different ways. One, a patient that is at a dental practice who is forward, who is doing this DNA test, is going to talk to their friends and go, "You won't believe what the dentist wanted me to do." And the friends are going to say, "Well, mine never did it. So it must be crazy." And they're going to get the feeling that they are in a practice that is just out for money. And that's not a good way of looking at this at all. We have to change that. We have to be more proactive with our patients and detect periodontal infections sooner. The other thing that we measure in the traditional old-fashioned way is the amount of bleeding that we see during our tissue manipulation. Now, patients for decades have been saying, well, for decades for me anyway, have been blaming us, hygienists, for causing their gums to bleed. And we're very careful about how much pressure we put on so that we don't create a bleeding situation that isn't a manifestation of a periodontal disease infection. So I've been very, very, very vocal about not using bleeding on probing as a marker, because it's imprecise, it's subjective, it doesn't help anybody, it can be a false reading for a long, long list of reasons, including adding too much pressure. Hygienists don't routinely measure the amount of pressure that they're putting onto the tissue. You could ask the next time you go, if you're a patient, if your dentist and your dental hygienist have recently been calibrated by the amount of pressure that they're putting on the probe. All of those kinds of things need to be addressed when we're talking about detecting a disease that has full body consequences. This is not just about losing teeth. So the most, well, it's not the most recent anymore, but recently I wrote a couple of articles giving hygienists pause to wonder about what it is that they're doing with respect to periodontal diagnostics. And of course, there was a huge pushback. There was an outrage. There was, you know, name calling. There was discomfort all around. The people who I made uncomfortable about doing this, we always were taught kind of practice, and I were just, you know, at odds. So I made them uncomfortable, and therefore they had to lash out, which is okay. That is one of the first stages of change, is to raise awareness. So I have awareness raised, and I'm continuing to always be trying to be on this front edge. And I'm only reading published research, so I'm not on the front edge. I am at least 2 or 3 years behind the front edge, okay? So just so you know how long it takes to get things into publication after the study is done, and the study is a year or so long, right? So if you're not up to me, you're not only 3 years behind, you are more than 3 years behind. Let's say it that way. Let's be kind. So recently, I wrote that article about bleeding on probing, and I was making people feel uncomfortable about it, and yada, yada. And so as I was looking for other things, I was stumbling across articles that were dealing with the idea of bleeding on probing, and what is that really telling us? Some of the studies were looking at whether or not you could look at bleeding on probing as a site for gathering blood for people to test people's blood glucose level. So what they were recommending is that we look at the bleeding that was occurring during probing, and we look at that blood as a way of measuring glucose. Okay, circulatory glucose, blood glucose. And early studies looking at this have kind of discounted it because there's so many, it's dirty. There's confounders in there. There's a piece of spaghetti in there from yesterday. There's, you know, there's a lot of confounders when you're looking at crevicular blood or pocket bleeding. But more recent research is saying, you know, there is a good... that is a good source of blood for detecting diabetes, and that maybe we should be looking at it more. Okay, I'll go along with that. So now, okay, I'm starting to get a little bit more comfortable with that, and here I see a study that was published last year. Let's see, when in last year? In September, so it wasn't all that long ago, now that it's May, in the Journal of Clinical Periodontology. And it was periodontitis in coronary heart disease patients, strong association between bleeding on probing and systemic biomarkers. That means that the action of bleeding on probing is associated with biomarkers that tell us that patients have an inflammatory condition. So here are the results. So this, I'm going to tell you the entire title of the paper. It is the periodontitis in coronary heart disease patients, strong association between bleeding on probing and systemic biomarkers. It was published in the Journal of Clinical Periodontology in 2014, November, e-published in September. The results were unadjusted linear regression showed significant associations between periodontal and systemic between periodontal and systemic parameters. The strongest association was found between bleeding on probing and C-reactive protein levels, the periodontal and systemic inflammation marker, respectively. Stepwise regression analysis models revealed that bleeding on probing was a predictor of systemic C-reactive protein levels. Bleeding on probing was the only periodontal parameter significantly associated with each parameter, including C-reactive protein, fibrinogen, and white blood cell count. The reason I'm bringing this to you right now is because out of all of the yammering that I've done against bleeding on probing and periodontal probing in general, not one single person that I know of or sent me a copy or a link to this paper. That tells me that the people who are so adamant about bleeding on probing number and periodontal depth readings are way behind, and they're not even going that extra 6 minutes to go to PubMed themselves and to find out how wrong I really was, to prove me wrong, other than to say that I am just all wet and that I should be strung up, that I am not a good hygienist, or that I'm crazy, or that I'm lazy, or whatever all they were saying. Unbelievable. I had to come across this myself. This is the only paper I can find that looks well on periodontal bleeding on probing.
If you enjoy the content and point of view, please leave a favorable review on Stitcher, iTunes, or Blog Talk Radio. To have Shirley be your personal oral health coach, you can reach out to her via email, shirley@crosslinkradio.com. And now, back to the show.
And that brings us to the treatment of periodontal disease and how best to treat that infection. The thing is that we have been looking at periodontal disease as a site-specific disease. I'm pretty sure it is still taught that way in dental hygiene school, that it is site-specific. I don't know if it's taught this way in dental school or not. I really don't know about dental hygiene school either when you come right down to it, but it appears to me that it is still taught as a site-specific disease. That is, that it is going to be, it's going to be obvious on a tooth or on a part of a tooth, okay, or on a couple of teeth in a mouth, that it is not necessarily a mouth-wide disease. It is taught as site-specific, and the treatment has been focused on removing the hard deposits that accumulate on the teeth in the pocket. So if you have periodontal disease that was only measured by pockets presence, the presence of pockets, then yes, you have to get rid of that calculus, the hard deposit that forms on the teeth in the pocket under the gums where you can't see it. If you're only waiting for people to have bone loss in order to treat that infection, that is appropriate. The question has become whether or not to treat one quarter of the mouth at a time or to treat the entire mouth as a whole. So here we sit. Patients don't like coming back four times to have a quarter of their mouth treated. When you think about any other infection or any other wound in the body, nobody in medicine treats one part of it. If you were in a car crash, they wouldn't treat only one arm that was all bashed up and cut and bruised and leave the other arm for another week. They would treat both arms. They would treat everything all at once. And patients who have periodontal treatment all at once have to sit in the chair or lay in the chair for an extended amount of time, usually 90 to 120 minutes, so an hour and a half to 2 hours. So the studies have been going back and forth about whether or not this is a good idea or not. And the most recent study here is from 2013. The Journal of Indian Sociology and Periodontology. Is that, I made that up maybe. I don't know what the second word is there. Journal of Indian SOC and Periodontology. Anyway, it's from 2013. So they evaluated the effect of one stage versus two stage full mouth disinfection on C-reactive protein, leukocyte, which is white blood cell count, in patients with chronic periodontitis. So what they did is they had two different treatment protocols. One was to treat the entire mouth at one time, getting rid of all the calculus and treating each site on each tooth in each mouth, and doing a full mouth disinfection where they would use an ultrasonic scaler and go around all of the teeth all of the time, but concentrate on a half of the mouth and then had the people back for a look at the other half of the mouth. So I'll just do the materials and methods. A total of 20 patients were selected and were divided into two groups. Group 1 received one stage full mouth disinfection, and group 2 received two stages of full mouth disinfection. They measured the plaque index, which is how much plaque is on the teeth, sulcus bleeding index, probing depth, clinical attachment loss, which are all subjective. They also measured the serum C-reactive protein, and the white blood cell count were evaluated for both groups at baseline and 1 month post-treatment. The conclusions of this study are as such. They are written out like this. I'm just going to read it to you. The therapeutic intervention may have a systemic effect on blood count on periodontitis patients. The one-stage full mouth disinfected had limited benefits over two-stage full mouth disinfection. The therapy can be accomplished in a shorter duration. So blood-wise, you're going to get the same results if you do it all at once or in two appointments. But time-wise, and time is money, you can do it all in one appointment and get the same results as you can in two appointments. So that is the short answer for that kind of a discussion. It is very, very, very rare that a study is looking at blood values in patients in these studies. It is almost all about pocket depth reading and bleeding on probing. And that's where all of this stuff comes to a head. That's where the pimple turns white. It comes to a head and we're all sitting here wondering, you know, you're just doing it and doing it and doing it and not giving it any critical thought. I was listening to a podcast the other day talking about physicians who are not taught critical thinking skills. Nobody is taught critical thinking skills. Everybody must think their way through and wonder if what they're doing is really the best for their patient. And you have to do that every year. You have to reevaluate everything every year. And this was not what I was going to plan to say, but I'm going to say it anyway. There are a lot of hygienists whose hours are being cut. They are asked to clock out when their patients don't show up. So patients, please show up for your appointments. During that time, though, the hygienist is theoretically inactive and they're not doing anything. This is the time for that kind of introspection. When you have an hour of downtime, if you are in a very busy practice where people actually do show up for their appointments all the time, then do it on Saturday or do it in the evening. But every year you need to set aside time to evaluate what you're doing. What has the research shown? What is it that you're doing that could be done better or faster? Or what can you now finally get rid of? I'm going to go out on a limb here and I'm going to say that you have x-rays. You know that there's bone loss. You're not measuring how much the bone is increasing, because when you do periodontal therapy, the gingiva, the gum tissue shrinks. So you have a weird number there once that happens. So I am a strong advocate for doing better periodontal treatments. Periodontal diagnostics are critical. We have a full body consequence for this. We have to start really treating it as if it is a full body thing, not just a tooth thing. There are a number of practices who are doing it this way. It's hard to find them. You may find more in a holistic practice, although I can't be sure of that. I do know that if you are looking for a new practice and you find a dental practice who is using ozone, those doctors get it. And I have to say that I'm extremely disappointed to find that the hygienists who are practicing in those practices where the dentist is using ozone are not using the ozone effectively. They don't get it, and they're not thinking their way through. So although you may have a very advanced thinking dentist, you may not have an advanced thinking dental hygienist. So patients need to ask questions, and hygienists need to ask questions of themselves. They need to really think, how long have I been doing this? This is a kind of thing that we'll be doing in my new eyes dental hygienist support consulting kind of a service. I hate calling it consulting. But these are the kinds of things we would work out in your own practice and work on so that you can develop a practice that you can feel comfortable with, that's always moving and that's always growing. And that your patients are always getting healthier. That is how you establish yourself as a critical component of a dental practice, of a dental team. And that's how you make yourself indispensable. And that's how you use your time where you do have downtime. Use it effectively to increase your importance in the dental practice. So, the research is getting more and more behind me. I have to say it. It's kind of irritating to have to toot your own horn. It's not something that most people are comfortable with, and I hope I'm doing it in a way that isn't turning people off. But when I read that paper about the C-reactive protein and that it is matched with bleeding on probing, I thought, well, there is a reason to measure bleeding on probing. But what we really need to do is we need to do a saliva test, a DNA test to test for the pathogens that are known to be present when periodontal infections are present. We need to measure the C-reactive proteins so that we can have a good idea of what our treatment is and better measurement of the treatment outcome. And we have to be more cognizant of what it is that we're doing. We are not saving teeth. That is the fifth thing down the list of what we're doing for our patients. People all know people who have lost teeth and they've done just fine. If you've been listening for a while, you know the story of Stephen and how he has been fighting these infections for a long time, and he's finally had his teeth removed, and now I'm afraid he's having airway issues because his teeth are no longer there holding his tongue in confinement. So it's always all attached. It's always part of every discussion on health that is out there. Thank you so much for your continued support of CrossLink Radio. And the easiest way to continue to support me is not just to listen in, although I appreciate that 100%, but to share these views, to share with your patients, to share with your hygienist and your dentist, to share it with your family members, and make comments in the comment section. If I'm all wet, if you think I'm all wet, put it in there. If you think that I'm the best thing since sliced bread, oh no, we're off of grains. If you think I'm the best thing since olive oil, yay. Put it down. I appreciate every comment. I'm not afraid of the comments. If I don't respond to the comments, it's because there are so few that I hardly ever check. So contact me at crosslinkpresent@aol.com or my new email address, shirley@crosslinkradio, and we'll keep in touch. And if you'd like to have me consult with you on your oral care or your oral hygiene, or if you'd like me to include you in our next class of for dental hygienist support, let me know, shirley@crosslinkradio, and I hope to see you soon.